This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 7th, 2006. From the Capitol Hill Bureau in Washington, D.C., I'm Ingrid Drake, sitting in for Aura Bogado. In today's newscast, voters face obstacles at the polls. The push for voting rights for non-citizen U.S. residents. Some towns decide whether to impeach President Bush. We'll have those stories and more, but first, the news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Panama today won a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Panama was chosen as a compromise country after a deadlock between Guatemala and Venezuela failed to produce a two-thirds majority needed to fill the position. The term of the non-permanent Security Council seat lasts 2 years. The Israeli army today ended its siege on Beit Hanun, repositioning its troops in outlying areas of the northern Gaza Strip. Rami Almagari reports from Gaza City.
The Israeli army redeployed Tuesday on the outskirts of Beit Hanun after a six-day military offensive that left over 50 Palestinian men, women and children dead and about 240 others wounded. Israeli army officials said the purpose of attack on Beit Hanun was to prevent Palestinian resistance groups from firing homemade rockets on nearby Israeli towns. It is the same rationale that has been used to justify frequent Israeli attacks on the town since the outbreak of the latest Palestinian uprising in 2000. Israeli army attacks continue in nearby towns. Today, Israeli missiles hit the house of Palestinian MP Jamil Al-Shanti, killing one Palestinian woman. In other news, both Fatah and Hamas have agreed on a national unity government, excluding current Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas. Yet no final agreement has been reached due to discussion of details. From imemc.org, I am Rami Almirari reporting from Gaza.
A man convicted of plotting terrorist attacks in the UK and the US began serving a life sentence in Britain today. 34-year-old Darren Barat pleaded guilty of conspiracy to murder. A 2-year-long police investigation concluded that Barat had planned to kill thousands of people by coordinating a series of bomb attacks at key locations in London, New York, Washington, D.C., and Newark, New Jersey. His alleged cohorts will reportedly face trial next year. 5 supposed guerrilla groups have claimed responsibility for a series of bomb blasts that rattled Mexico City yesterday. Tim Russo has the story.
As long as Ulysses Ruiz remains officially in the Oaxacan governorship, our militants and combatants will continue to act politically and militarily against the politicians responsible for this situation, read the communique signed by 5 guerrilla organizations. Mexico's Federal Investigations Agency is currently investigating the authenticity of the claim. The communique confirmed the placement of 8 bombs in different locations in Mexico City. 2 exploded in a Revolutionary Institutional Party's headquarters, 2 detonated in the Federal Electoral Tribunal, and 2 more went off in a Scotiabank branch location. Police discovered 2 other bombs in front of a second bank and a well-known restaurant chain, Sanborns. President Vicente Fox condemned the bombings as a criminal act, yet held a confident position that they do not affect the security of Mexico. The APO, Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, once again distanced itself from the bombings, accusing the government of looking for a justification to violently repress the popular movement in Oaxaca, which is in its 170th day of conflict today. As this story goes to air, the Federal Preventative Police was engaging in an extensive search for possible explosives that may have been planted in the Federal Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo in Mexico.
Voters across the U.S. head to the polls today. To begin our election coverage, Christy LaPuma Herrera looks at the tight race for a Virginia Senate seat.
Democratic challenger Jim Webb, a Vietnam veteran and former Navy secretary, has had to work extra hard to garner female voter support after incumbent Republican George Allen drew attention to articles Webb authored in the Vietnam era, questioning women's place in combat and in the U.S. Naval Academy. Allen's major struggle has been to retain GOP party loyalists. Many disapprove of Allen's consistent support for some of the Bush administration's more unpopular policies. The deciding factor in the poll today may center around the marriage ballot initiative. One voter who did not wish to be named said one of the main reasons she voted for Allen was his support for the amendment.
Unfortunately, the courts in the country have decided that they're the ones who are going to decide what constitutes a legal marriage rather than letting the people decide. And Virginia has gotten to the point that we feel that we need to go out and put something on our Constitution to let the judges know what the people of Virginia feel. And so that's what the amendment's about.
The amendment would be the third clause in Virginia's Constitution that specifically prohibits same-sex marriages, leaving many convinced that the redundant amendment is mostly designed to attract conservative voters to the polls. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christy Lee Puma Herrera in Fairfax, Virginia.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News. In addition to the 435 House seats, 33 Senate races, gubernatorial and local races, there are more than 200 ballot initiatives for voters across the U.S. San Franciscans will decide whether employers should provide paid sick leave, and three states will take a position on pulling U.S. troops from Iraq. After years of struggling to protect affirmative action, Michigan activists have been fighting another ballot initiative, funded primarily by out-of-state sources, that would prohibit those policies. Ballot initiatives banning same-sex marriage have shown up in eight states, a Republican tactic that could attract conservative voters to the polls. It is also unclear whether ballot initiatives in six states supporting a minimum wage increase will boost Democratic turnout. Thousands of monitors deployed to the polls are observing the election process. With the precinct still open, observers' early results are mixed, with some citing systemic problems with the U.S. voting system. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Washington, D.C.
Aisha Satterwhite voted in Prince George's County, Maryland, a predominantly African-American region in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. She waited in line for nearly 2 hours to cast her vote.
As I moved through the line, the same amount of people were coming in as when I came in, so I don't think it was moving any faster.
Denver voters are also standing in long lines with reports of voters leaving before they reach the polls. Long lines are just one complaint from voters around the country. The Election Protection Coalition, several dozen groups that have compiled resources to monitor the elections, reports technology problems in Ohio. Several calls to the coalition hotline said the touchscreen voting system highlighted the wrong candidate. In Indiana, problems with the machines were reported in 75 precincts. Pennsylvania is also having technological problems, and it caused polls to open late in Florida and Illinois, the coalition says. Mix-ups in voter identification laws are being reported in Arizona and Ohio. In one section of Prince George's County, Maryland, poll workers told voters to provide picture ID, which is not what the law requires there. Jonah Goldman is an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. He says the U.S. voting system needs more attention by the government.
An underfunded, under-resourced system with people and mechanisms that can't handle the electorate. So, unfortunately, voters across the country are being disenfranchised.
But not everyone is experiencing voting problems. Kim Haven with Justice Maryland has spent the day visiting polls throughout Baltimore.
Right now, I'm actually kind of impressed with it's moving very smoothly, but I noticed this morning that voter turnout in the polls was kind of light.
Under the new Help America Vote Act, voters experiencing problems at the polls can fill out a provisional ballot. But many states won't count those until days after the election. And also for many states, absentee ballots aren't counted until several days later either. This could prolong the outcome or prematurely decide the winner. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
While it is unclear if a shift in party control of the U.S. Congress will lead to impeachment proceedings for President Bush, seven towns are voting today on impeach Bush ballot initiatives. The little state of Connecticut is home this year to four congressional races of national significance, and the campaigning has been furious, expensive, and dirty. In the best-known race, wealthy anti-war newcomer Ned Lamont beat three-term Democratic senator and Iraq war booster Joe Lieberman in the party's primary in August. But Lieberman stayed in the race, creating his own party to try to hold on to his seat, and is leading in the polls. He has vowed to caucus with the Democrats if he wins re-election. Meanwhile, in three races that could help put the House in Democratic hands, the state's three Republican incumbent Congress members are all facing tough challenges from progressive Democrats. The state's two Democratic members of Congress face no significant challenges. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus has been following all these races and files this roundup.
This is what Ned Lamont said the night he won the Democratic primary by 4 points.
I am proud to carry the banner as the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate.
Since then, Lamont has struggled to broaden his candidacy beyond his anti-war stance, presenting positions on universal health care, energy independence, and civil liberties that are at odds with those held by both Lieberman and President George W. Bush, to whom Lamont ties his opponent at every opportunity. At many post-primary campaign stops, Lamont hasn't even mentioned the war. Lieberman has promoted himself as a man of experience who can work bipartisan magic in Congress. For example, although labor support is split down the middle between Lieberman and Lamont, one Connecticut labor leader explains why he wants to return the incumbent to Washington.
Joe stood with us time and again when we fought at Yale for good contracts.
Bob Proto is president of the Blue Collar Union at Yale University and vice president of his local's parent union, Unite Here.
We also respect Joe in regards to his ability to bring Connecticut tax dollars back to Connecticut based on his experience, his influence, and his knowledge of the inner workings of Washington.
Lieberman's strategy seems to be working, as he has the support of the vast majority of the state's Republicans, who are shunning their own candidate, as well as support from one-third of Democrats and half the state's majority independents. President Bush has singled out Lieberman for praise, and Vice President Dick Cheney has likened Lamont's supporters to terrorist sympathizers. In the final days of the campaign, Lamont has returned to his focus on the war. But despite the fact that 60% of the state's voters are against the war, Lamont is still trailing in the polls. Between them, Lamont and Lieberman have raised about $35 million for the campaign, creating such an avalanche of television ads, mailers, and phone calls that most voters can't wait for Election Day to be over. Meanwhile, in the three House races, the Democratic challengers are doing their best to tie the Republican incumbents to George Bush's war and his attacks on civil liberties. These races are all closer than the Senate matchup. According to a University of Connecticut poll of likely voters, incumbent Rob Simmons has a 2-point lead over challenger Joe Courtney. 24-year incumbent Nancy Johnson is trailing challenger Chris Murphy by 4 points, and 19-year incumbent Christopher Shays is tied with challenger Diane Farrell at 43% each. However, other polls show Farrell with a significant lead. It's noteworthy that while Johnson has raised the most money of all the candidates, $4.4 million to her opponent's $1.9 million, she is the furthest behind. It could be because voters are fed up with negative campaigning. In Johnson's case, she approved an ad charging that Murphy's support for civil liberties was aiding the terrorists. In Shay's case, an ad by the National Republican Campaign Committee, which he condemned, accused Farrell of wanting to have coffee talk with the Taliban. Supporters of the Democratic challengers have been going door-to-door in their districts for the past several weeks. Stumping for Diane Farrell, volunteers found an older Ukrainian-American couple with strong views on the election.
Well, I go for Diane. I'm a Democrat.
I think that congressman, what we have now, is a good man. And she doesn't have experience. She said, go out from Iraq. Where we go? She doesn't have experience in politics. That's what I feel. Well, I know I'm against the war, too, but what are you going to do now?
Bush went too far.
But how you go back?
If I hear my son, my grandson, nobody there, American soldier killed, make me sick.
Meanwhile, Republicans, who have usually demonstrated the more impressive get-out-the-vote operation, are pushing to maintain their record. Jim Conroy is director of the Connecticut Victory Program for the Republican Party.
We've spent a lot of time, you know, moving up to the election, you know, trying to get a better idea of who our supporters are, you know, both Republicans, you know, Democrats and unaffiliated as well. You know, people have been lining up to, you know, say, how can I help? You know, they want to be involved in this effort, and it's obviously important to all of us to make sure that our people go back.
All the candidates believe the door-to-door efforts will be pivotal to victory in these races. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Fairfield, Connecticut.
New Mexico's 1st Congressional District is considered a pivotal race for Democrats' efforts to gain control of the House of Representatives. Republican Heather Wilson, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, could lose her seat. The race is targeted by the national parties as well as the national special interest groups. Leslie Clark reports most of the money spent by the organizations is going towards negative campaigning.
New Mexico's 1st Congressional District is the largest in the state and includes the Albuquerque area. District 1's Republican incumbent, Heather Wilson, is being challenged by New Mexico Attorney General, Democrat Patricia Madrid. Rather than extolling their own stance on issues, the two candidates are concentrating on negative advertising.
Heather Wilson admitted helping George Bush cover up the truth about Iraq. She was on the Armed Services Committee and knew the intelligence was wrong from the beginning.
Conversely, Wilson is accusing Madrid of being bad for national security. National Republican Campaign Committee spokesman Alex Burgos says the committee has spent more than $2 million on advertising in the New Mexico race.
Any type of advertising related to a campaign serves a purpose of informing voters on where the candidates stand on the issues. The fact that Heather Wilson has run advertisements highlighting her opponent's record of failure and inaction, and you know, voters should be outraged at more at Patsy Madrid than at Heather Wilson for running, you know, for highlighting that fact.
But 1st District voter Rob Rauchy disagrees. He says voters should be educated on the candidate's position on issues like the war in Iraq, health care, and education, instead of just hearing one candidate berate the other.
I really tune out the negative advertising. I think it's unnecessary. I think it's unwarranted. I think it's ridiculous. And those people should be ashamed of themselves. They really should. If this is what peace and love and justice is all about, I don't want to have any part of it. I'll do my job. I'll vote. I'll vote my conscience. But the negative advertising has got to stop. It has got to stop.
Negative advertising does work, according to University of New Mexico political science professor and analyst Lana Atkinson. Dr. Atkinson says negative campaigning works because it allows candidates to frame the debate.
You want to be in a position of power to set the agenda on issues that help yourself and hurt the other guy. And that's part of the negative, you know, that's part of the negative campaigning. You know, people do it. I mean, the public says they hate it, but when actually we look at it, it really does help to often educate them about the importance of issues. In some cases, we find a very positive effect of negative campaigning because in some ways, a really negative campaign means that it's very close. And a close campaign draws voters out.
New Mexico's 1st congressional district race is a statistical dead heat as voters go to the polls. The state is using paper ballots for the first time in this election, so New Mexicans may not learn who will be representing them in next year's Congress on election night. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Only voters in Washington, D.C. will be voting for a shadow senator and representative, largely ceremonial posts for raising awareness about D.C.'s lack of congressional voting representation. A third-party contender, the Statehood Green Party, is running competitive candidates for these seats. Nationally, 330 Green Party candidates are seeking a wide range of offices, including governor and attorney general. Meanwhile, in Washington state, Democrats seeking to reclaim the House have 15 top priorities. One of them is the 8th Congressional District in Seattle's East Side suburbs. The 8th District has been held up by Republicans since it was created in 1980, but polls show that the race between Republican incumbent David Reichert and Democratic challenger Darcy Berner is in a dead heat. Martha Baskin has our story.
The significance of the race came home when Senator Barack Obama took time from a sold-out book tour to rally for the Democrats and Washington State's 8th District Democratic challenger, Darcy Berner. Issues such as affordable education, health care, decent jobs, respect for the Constitution, and global warming took center stage. Obama noted that while gas prices may have been deliberately lowered just before the election, it didn't mean people weren't aware of the need for a sustainable energy future.
Although I know that there are a couple of scientists in the White House who still deny that climate change has taken place, the other 10,000 outside the White House have decided that maybe this thing we should take seriously. And so people say, why not? Why not make a change?
Darcy Berner's personal and professional background offer crossover appeal in a district that includes independents, as well as mainstream party loyalists, rural and working class families, as well as those who work at Microsoft. Her mother was a public school teacher, and her father spent 20 years in the Air Force. Berner's brother continues to serve. She earned a scholarship to Harvard and worked at Microsoft for 6 years. When her son was born 3 years ago, she took a step back and asked how she could give him the kind of world she wanted him to have. Her answer, run for Congress.
I want my son to grow up in a country where the United States Congress answers to the people, not merely the president or the party.
Her timing and the district's increasingly centrist demographics appear to be helping her campaign. Her Republican opponent, Dave Reichert, a former county sheriff, is having a hard time justifying his party's position and his voting record on such issues as global warming, an unpopular war, and the economy, which coincidentally are Berner's top priorities. Like the Bush administration, Reichert is fanning fears of tax increases by Democrats. A Reichert campaign ad claims Berner is in trouble for pushing a tax plan that will punish millions.
Higher taxes on families, taxes on marriage, on death.
Verner wants the job but has no experience, no public service, calling for taxes we can't afford. Dave Reichert's keeping taxes low with experience to back it up.
I'm Dave Reichert, and I approve this message.
But Verner isn't afraid to set the record straight, as she puts it.
We need to make sure that our tax policies reward work, not just accumulated wealth. We need to extend the tax credits that are available to lower the taxes on most families while making sure that corporations and the very wealthy pay their fair share.
The Campaign for America's Future, a progressive think tank, says Berner is one of many candidates who are willing to challenge the shift in tax burden and point out that taxpayer subsidies for corporations and millionaires are bankrupting the nation. Roger Hickey, co-director of the campaign.
She's being very, very clear that she may roll back some taxes for some wealthy Americans, but she's out for tax relief and tax justice for the vast majority of her constituents.
The National Republican Congressional Committee won't divulge how much it's spending in this particular race. In 2004, they spent more than $4 million, but they're committed to making sure Dave Reichert returns to Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting from Seattle.
Most people are used to the idea that only U.S. citizens can vote in U.S. elections. Legislators in several states and the U.S. House of Representatives have recently hammered out laws to require voters to prove citizenship at the polls. Against this tide to bar non-U.S. citizens from voting, a coalition in New York is campaigning to include non-citizens in the electoral process. Jan Mejia has the story.
New York City Councilmember Democrat Charles Barron has authored a bill to allow legal immigrants to vote in city elections.
There are about 1.3 million immigrants who are legal residents here, who pay billions of dollars into the economy of New York City, who can also be a volunteer for the Army and go die in the Iraqi war in New York City. And past history in America, when immigration was predominantly white, they were allowed to vote, and so I think that they should be accorded the right to participate in deciding who are going to be making some of these decisions in their life.
Several dozen immigrants advocacy groups, civil rights organizations, and labor unions have united around Barron's proposal and formed the New York Coalition to Expand Voting Rights. Cheryl Wirth directs the Government Access Division at the New Immigrants Community Empowerment, a member of the coalition. Wirth's organization recently completed a survey on immigrants' political views.
What we found is that non-citizens and citizens largely care about the same things. They want quality education, they want affordable housing, they want clean streets, they want quality public transportation.
While advocates of immigrants' voting rights in New York are fighting to gain public awareness of such an idea, residents in several Maryland cities have long accepted the fact that non-citizens can vote as well. Kathy Porter is mayor of Tacoma Park in Maryland. She says legal immigrants in her city have been voting in municipal elections for more than a decade.
The way we were hoping that they would react was to become more involved in the community. And I think that's slowly happening. The law allowing people who are not U.S. citizens to vote in our community is one of our ways of telling them that they are important to us and we care what their concerns are and we care what they think.
Bills or ballot initiatives extending voting rights to non-citizens have emerged in a dozen other states, including Massachusetts, Minnesota, California, and Washington, D.C. in the past several years. Many of them fell short of passing the finishing line. So far, the New York Coalition has been campaigning for non-citizens' voting rights in local elections only.
National citizenship is an entirely different issue. It involves emotional commitments, it involves foreign policy, and it involves a much, much deeper level of education and commitment.
That's Michelle Wooker, co-director of the Immigrant Voting Project. Her colleague, another founder of the Immigrant Voting Project, Ron Haydock, believes non-citizens should be allowed to participate in every election held in this nation.
Non-citizens had the right to vote in the United States from the very founding, from 1776, right on through until 1926, which is 150 years, and they voted not just in local elections, but also in state and federal elections, and not just in part of the country, but in 40 states and federal territories. And non-citizens could also run and hold office, and they did.
Charles Barron's bill has gained support from 40 members out of 51 in the New York City Council. He says he's still short of convincing Speaker Christine Quinn to take up his proposal. Speaker Quinn, a Democrat representing a Manhattan district, did not return our phone calls requesting for an interview. Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie.
Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in two similar challenges to the federal abortion ban, also known as the partial birth abortion ban of 2003. The ban, passed by Congress and signed by President Bush in 2003, would criminalize abortions as early as 12 to 15 weeks of pregnancy that doctors say are safe and the best way to protect women's health. Nan McCurdy has more from Washington, D.C.
Both of the appellate courts that reviewed these cases found the federal abortion ban unconstitutional, citing previous law established over the last 30 years that protects the health of the woman. They decided against the federal abortion ban because, among other things, the ban would prevent doctors from performing some of the safest procedures, starting as early as 12 weeks of pregnancy. Nancy Keenan is president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America.
Here we have, for more than 30 years, the Supreme Court has held that politicians cannot endanger women's health when they regulate or restrict abortion care.
Just 6 years ago, in Stenberg versus Carhart, the Supreme Court struck down a Nebraska law banning partial birth abortions, a derogatory name for a procedure known medically as intact dilation and extraction, which reduces trauma to the uterus. The Nebraska law was found unconstitutional because, among other things, it did not protect women's health, and its vague language could be interpreted more broadly to include banning other procedures. Nothing has changed since the Stenberg versus Carhart decision 6 years ago. No new facts or evidence have emerged to justify the Supreme Court revisiting this case. The only change is in the makeup of the court, with the departure of Sandra Day O'Connor, who gave the decisive fifth vote 6 years ago to strike down the Nebraska law banning partial birth abortions, and the addition of Justices John Roberts and Samuel A. Alito, appointed by President Bush. Nancy Keenan.
And yet this Supreme Court, very politicized, decided to take up this issue. And that, to us, is of grave concern, because now we know the court has shifted. We are very concerned now that balance has tipped. And in essence, what this translates to for women across this country is that they could outlaw abortion as early as 12 weeks, and that the woman's health would not have to be taken into consideration. And that is, for American women in this country, is very, very devastating.
With the changes in the makeup of the court, what are people saying about a likely ruling on this issue? Joe Scheidler, national director of the Pro-Life Action League, an activist organization, explains why he thinks the court is revisiting this issue and what it would mean if the court upholds the federal abortion ban.
They want to show that they made a mistake 6 years ago. They had different judges than we now have. And so if the Supreme Court would rule that it is illegal to do that kind of abortion, it would be the beginning of denying almost all forms of abortion in time.
Up to now, every court that has examined the federal abortion ban has struck it down because it does not protect women's health. For Free Speech Radio News from Washington, D.C., I'm Nan McCurdy.
Free Speech Radio News has a worker-run collective. For archives of this and other newscasts, fsrn.org. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Ingrid Drake.
Pa' que vean que sí se puede.